This is January 12th. It's Debbie Goldman interviewing Brooks Sunkett in Washington, D.C. And Brooks, we start at the beginning. Tell us when you were born and where and what the community was like.
Okay, I was born in a working class community in New Jersey in 1948.
What town?
It's Camden, New Jersey. At that time, Camden was a union town. Had a lot of major industries there. New York Shipyard, General Electric, RCA, Campbell Soups, and all those industries were unionized. And, of course, a host of other type of industries.
And what did your family do?
My father worked for RCA. He started out as a janitor, and he became a wireman. It was a shop that built TVs and et cetera. And he was part of IUE. That was his union. So I've always familiar with that at a very young age. And he always proudly wore his badge around. So.
Was he active in the union?
I don't think so. I think he went to the union meetings, but he wasn't like a shop steward or anything.
And your mom?
My mother was a nurse, but basically...
Let's hold for a second.
I should actually unplug that. I still have a landline in my house. Do I use it? No, but...
No, I do too.
Are we taping?
Yeah, it's fine.
It usually rings 4 or 5 times.
Okay, do you want to re-ask the question?
And tell us about your mom.
No, she was a nurse. She was an activist, very much so, up until, I mean... Well into her late 70s. She was a nurse, but generally she was a stay-at-home mother. And she always believed in the community, going out helping people. I remember at a very early age, there was a fire not too far from us. She got us all, we went to visit the family that was burned out and see what we could do to help them out. She was that type of person. So she was very aggressive in that way. She was the type of person, didn't mind taking on City Hall. I remember once there was a traffic light. People were getting killed at a certain intersection. And she had gone to ask them for a traffic light. And they hadn't gotten it in months and months. So she got together, organized a community, and had a protest, and went out and stopped traffic. It made news all over the place, but they got their traffic light. So she was always active in those type of activities, she was a community activist.
And that was an influence on you?
I'm sorry?
That was an influence on you?
Absolutely. Huh? And she always told us, don't be afraid and stand up for what is right. And that, you know, not only you should do it, you have an obligation to do it.
So. How many siblings?
There were 9 of us. And I'm second eldest.
Okay.
So everybody's it was younger than me.
So that was quite a challenge to raise 9 kids.
Well, she did it very well. She was very systematic.
And what kind of community in Camden did you live in?
I was born at a house, and it was a mixed community. Like I said, it was a working class community. Camden, like most of the cities in the Northeast, started going down. Industry started moving out. We moved out to the suburbs probably when I was about in the 7th, 8th grade, and which is Lawnside, New Jersey.
Say it again.
Lawnside, New Jersey. It's not much, I mean, most people don't know about it. What's unique about the town, it was founded by runaway slaves. It's an all-black community. It's the only all-black community north of the Mason-Dixie line.
Can you spell it?
L-A-W-N, Lawn, Side, S-I-D-E.
Wow, what an interesting background.
It's right outside of Haddonfield, Cherry Hill, New Jersey. It's about 10 miles from Camden.
And so when you were in Camden, you said it was a mixed community. Mixed, what way?
It started out being a mixed community. Eventually changed.
But mixed meaning white-black?
Meaning white and black, right.
And then?
I remember that. So we moved out of that community back when I was about 7, 8 years old. So...
And you moved to a different neighborhood.
We moved to another neighborhood, which was basically the projects, which wasn't that far away. And that was because they were going to decimate the neighborhood because they were building a highway through.
And when you moved to the projects, you were in public housing?
Yes.
Tell me about what it was like to live in. Were these high rise or low rise?
No, these were low rise. They were like garden apartments, so almost like condos. Everybody had their own private entrance, except their back door, little small backyard.
It helped make it a little more affordable to raise 9 kids.
Right. Well, you know, there was 9 of us at that point. I think there were maybe about 5 of us, 6 of us. So.
And you went to elementary school where?
In Camden. The first years of my life was in Camden. Ironically, one of the heads of AT&T, probably about 10 years ago, his name was Gordon. I don't know if you would remember him.
Gordon.
No, it was a guy.
Yeah, Bruce.
That was his name.
I think, who became top exec in CMP, and then he went to the Urban League, I think.
Right. His father was my grammar school principal.
Really?
Yeah. I didn't know him, but there were people in my community that knew him. I found that out because he was having he was being honored in South Jersey, and I was told about it, and I went to it and introduced myself. We talked a little bit.
How nice.
Yeah.
I'm sorry. Was your family active in the church?
Very active.
Which church?
Very
and talk
active.
About it.
My mother's father was a minister, which I never met because he died before I was born. And so there's a church called Bethel AME Church in Camden, which is a lot of our family helped find that church. So we were all members of that until we moved alongside. So I could go to church every Sunday and see half my family up in there, right? So, and that church, as far as I know, is still there. It's a pretty old church.
Was that formative in you shaping your values?
I think so. I
in
think
what
church
way?
Definitely. Well, it talked about doing right and wrong. It talked about supporting people. It talked about working with people, trying to get along with people. So I think so. And my mother was always in church. She, you know, we went every Sunday, regardless.
Are you still active in the church?
Who? I am not. No, I am not.
Did your family come up from the South?
No. Well, I should say no. My father did. And it was years and years before I thought about it, but I was actually from his side of the family, first generation born in the North. My mother's family has been here for generations.
Where'd your father's family come from?
Virginia.
Okay.
And the name Sunkett, thus, is from Virginia. And I didn't actually go there. Well, I don't have recollection of going until I was an adult. So I did go to Melfort, Virginia.
And Sunkett is from Virginia. What did you mean?
I'm sorry?
When you said Sunkett is from Virginia, what did you mean?
Well, I just meant the family name came through Virginia.
Okay.
Stuff you don't give much thought to when you were young. You know, you just kind of go along with stuff. But anyway, and I got all that kind of research. There is not another Sunkett in the United States that's not related to us.
Very interesting.
Right, so I did a little bit of background research on it.
Now you're in Lawnside. Where'd you go to high school?
High school, Hatton Heights High.
And you said it was an all-black community?
Which is, the high school is just the opposite. Because our community was too small, we didn't have our own high school. So there were 3 communities in the area. And that 3 communities made up the high school. So that was Barrington, Lawnside, and Hatton Heights. And high school was, you know, physically in Hatton Heights. And Hatton Heights, or in both those other communities, particularly Hatton Heights, was an all-white, upper-middle-class community. And we, you know, we went, that's where we went. But so the people that went to Lawnside, probably there was no more than 100 students at Hatton Heights. The school probably had about 800, 900 students. So we were truly minorities there.
And what was that like for you?
Well, it was different. I mean, it was and it wasn't. I grew up in Camden, so part of my life was in a mixed community. The other part was totally all black. And then you go to all black communities to finish out my grammar years, and then you go back into, you know, which, you know. And I didn't realize how few blacks there were in school until I actually looked back on it, because after a while you just adjust. But when I look at yearbooks, you go from page to page, you don't see any black people, right? I said, I didn't realize there were so few of us there. We had issues. There were skirmishes and difference because you had an upper middle class white community, you had a white working class community, and then you had white, black working class and poor all going to the same school. So you can see it could be some conflicts.
Were there activities where you all came together, or was it pretty segregated socially?
No, there were some. There were some activities, yeah, absolutely. I mean, we always come together around sports, except for basketball. We weren't allowed to play basketball. Why?
What?
I don't know. I know. That sounds weird. So there were no black people on the basketball team.
You weren't allowed?
Well, we assumed we weren't allowed because no black person could ever make the team.
Wow.
That happened after I left. That changed. I think it had a lot to do with the teacher.
Were you involved in sports?
I'm sorry?
Finish what you were saying.
No, I did go out for the team. I think you were going to ask me. I did go out for the team. No, I didn't make it. That was one of my passions, basketball.
Were you in any sports?
Yeah, I played football, and I ran track.
What position in football?
I was a cornerback and a halfback.
And what did you run in track?
Not too fast.
Not too fast. Okay.
The name Sunkett had a big name in that area because my cousins were all great athletes. This is probably a little off the subject, but my cousin went to a high school in Camden. During that time period, which was 1959, 1960, I would say, even when I look back on it, it's probably one of the greatest high school basketball teams in the history of sports in the United States. How do I say that? They won 50 straight games. And so the whole tenor while he was in high school, the whole era, they never lost a game.
This is Camden High School?
This is Camden High School.
Wow.
Which, unfortunately, does not exist. Like, you know, they tore it down. But anyway, so...
Well, let me ask you, besides your big family of nine siblings, it sounds like your extended family was in the area as well. Was that...
Yeah, my father's brother, who also had nine kids... And because the name Sunkett was so odd, and he was also a detective, so he was always in the newspaper locking somebody up and blah, blah, blah. His son was really big time because he was in, you know, high school basketball team that was undefeated for 3 years. So whenever you mention your name Sunkett, I mean, I could go to court and say, oh, you're Sunkett, and case dismissed. So I kind of lived that kind of a life too, right? And that's how I got to run track. That's a long way of saying that's how I run track. So the guy, track coach, comes to me and says, well, you're a Sunkett, so obviously you're a good athlete. And I said, well, I don't know. So he goes, why don't you come on for the track team? I said, I don't know any Sunkett that ran track. He goes, well, I'm sure you can do it. And that's how I got on the track team. So, you know, I did it for a year.
So during this time, the civil rights movement is particularly active, both in the South and the North.
Right.
What do you remember of your involvement, your family's involvement?
Well, you know, in my school, particularly because of the makeup, you had conflicts. Actually, I got together I had some great teachers. So we were supposed to put together a program around civil rights or whatever we wanted to. So my partner and I got together and we decided we'd do something on Martin Luther King. And rather than just talk about it, we figured we'd demonstrate it. So passive non-resistance. So we go into class, and we decided that we'd walk in. We wouldn't say a word to the teacher. We sat on his desk and wouldn't move. He freaked out because he didn't know what was going on. So we just sat there. And he started saying, okay, guys, give you a report. And we wouldn't even look at him. We turned away. And then he got upset, and he sent somebody to go get the principal. And at that point, we got up and said, this is part of our presentation. And then we started doing the presentation. He loved it so much that he took us out of our class, and we had to do all his classes the rest of the day. So that was the way to demonstrate what it was like, because he says, I couldn't actually do anything. They didn't say anything. They didn't do anything. And this is how it works. This is what they do in the South.
Were there demonstrations in Camden, and was your family involved?
Well, I did.
Or your church?
I mean, I got involved in some demonstrations later on when I got back from Vietnam. One of the things I had some problems with is that my school had no black teachers, and we wanted black teachers, you know, some, and we wanted some black history courses. And so we demonstrated at the school, and at this point, I was about 19 years old. I was about 20 because I'd gotten bad at service, and I came home. This is one of the things that, because I still had brothers and sisters still in high school, and they talked about it. I said, well, it's time for us to do something. We should demonstrate. And so we did, and we, you know, I think we won. We got some black courses introduced. Eventually, it took about a year or so, they eventually got a black teacher. And that school is totally different today. But going back a little bit, I actually did the same thing in the military, which was pretty risky. You know, I went to Vietnam. First of all, I was opposed to the war.
So now we're jumping.
I'm going back.
No, that's great. You finished high school and you were drafted?
Yeah, I was drafted. Okay. So the draft was still active then. I was drafted. The war was raging.
And you're about 18 years old?
Yeah. So I got drafted. They were upset with me, too, because you're supposed to sign up when you turn 18. I turned 18 in February. I never signed up. And I didn't think about it. So I became top priority. I didn't have plans to go to college right away. I was going to work and then I should go to college. And so when they called me up to the draft board and they told me my number was going to be moved up and you never signed up for the draft, you never signed up. And that, you know, it could be a problem. So that fall, I came out of school in June that fall.
What year?
1966. I got drafted in October and I was in, so.
Tell us a little bit about it.
I'm sorry.
Oh, keep going.
No, I had read a lot about the war and I was then very much opposed to the war. And then I was really big on Martin Luther King and I think I still got the album. He talks about the war and why it was bad. And, you know, that's why he became vilified after that.
So tell us about your service. How long were you in the service?
2 years.
In the Army?
Yeah, in the Army.
Tell us a little bit about it.
Well, I mean, I protested a little bit about the war, which was kind of nuts, because you're already there. In the military. I really didn't want to be there. And I went AWOL a couple times, knowing that, you know, I wouldn't stay AWOL. And when I got my orders to go to Vietnam, they sent you home for a couple weeks. And then I was supposed to report. So I came home in May. I was supposed to report early in June. Well, I wound up staying home pretty much the whole summer. which my parents said, don't you think you should be going back? Nah, I still got time. My father said, sure. I said, yeah. Anyway, I turned myself back in. And they locked me up. And it wasn't formal jail. You couldn't leave the barracks type of thing. So it wasn't like a formal jail or anything, but they called it that. And then I got, the mortars were changed, and then I went out to Seattle, Washington. Now, the reason that's significant because, so they didn't send me to Vietnam right away, which I would have been in Vietnam by that point had it not gone AWOL. We were in Seattle, Washington, because this was during a time period, you probably wouldn't remember this, and you might have been in high school at the time, when President Johnson had the big buildup. He said, we're going to send all these troops, that's going to make a difference. Well, I was part of that buildup. So they sent me to Seattle. Of course, I didn't know it then. They sent us to Seattle, and they had a setting there because all our training was done. They had a setting there, and we sat there for about, 60 days while they rounded up more troops and kept bringing them in. And the idea was to send us all over to Vietnam at one time, thinking it would flood it with troops. We could win the war that way. Of course, that was bad thinking. It didn't happen. But anyway, so I was part of that buildup. So I actually went over to Vietnam on a boat. One of the few people that went over from Vietnam on a boat. And it took us another 30 days by boat to get there.
1967 now?
That was 67, right.
And how long were you in Vietnam?
For a year. So I got home around latter part of 68.
I know it's tough to talk about, but
it
anything
is.
You want to... Okay.
No, that's okay. I'll talk about it. The summer was kind of crazy, but because I, one of the things I did when they sent us over there, so normally it sends you right into combat right away. They didn't send us in combat right away because we're all new, because we went over this big group. So they had us in the rear for a while, and while we're in the rear, they took us through various exercises. So one of the things I did, I tried to organize the troops there, and we started writing letters. And I wrote our congressman about the Vietnam, and I wrote Bobby Kennedy, which it caught up with me after I got back to the States, which is another whole story. But anyway, while I was in Vietnam, we had the different troops write to congressmen and talk about the war and why it was unfair, and we didn't want to be there. And we thought that, our involvement was wrong.
So how did your, I don't know what the right word would be, your platoon leader, your sergeant, your commanding officer, did they know you were doing this?
I don't think they did. I think they, we'd get together on Sundays and have people meet, come over to the mess hall, and we'd get together and sit down and talk about it and write. And it started off as a small group of us, three or four of us, and then it kind of grew. And I don't know if it got to a big portion, but it was like about 50 of us at one point.
And tell the Bobby Kennedy story.
Well, that, I'll be jumping ahead, but it's okay. Well, what happened is, so Kennedy responded, but he didn't respond to us. I was out of Vietnam. When I left Vietnam, I went to Fort Ord, California, which was crazy in itself. So that army base was set up, and they brought people back from Vietnam, and they segregated us off into another part of the post. You got to realize these posts are huge. And there were barracks and barracks of people that got back from Vietnam at some stage or another. And what they would do is take them out into the desert and keep them out there all week. And what they would do is test. They would run tests on them.
These are the returnees.
These were returning veterans, Army veterans, and would actually play war games. I never went. Time I got back, because I went AWOL, I had to do an extra 30 days. But that was it, and my time was up. So I had like 3 weeks to go. And I told him, I said, I'm not doing that. That's nuts. I came from a real war, and I'm going to go play war. I'm not doing it. So one of the things that saved me, Bobby Kennedy's letter, he started an investigation of the post. So I guess what happened, and I can only think this was what happened, is that it followed me from where I went. And so it came to Fort Ord. I was called into commanding officer's office. He said, and this is how he said it, so it's part of the language. Who in the fuck do you know in Washington, D.C.? Because of you, this whole post is under investigation. And I was thinking, what the hell is he talking about? Because I had long forgotten that I had written those letters. And later on, I found out it was the letters, and it was Bobby Kennedy doing an investigation. So...
that's quite a story.
Yeah, so I think they were afraid to send me out.
So in Vietnam, again, I don't want to bring
ahead.
That
That's fine.
Bad. No, that's... You were in combat?
Yes. Yes, I was.
Do you want to say anything about it?
I don't know. You have to ask me some questions, I guess.
I'm not sure what to ask.
Well, whatever comes to mind.
I assume it was horrible.
I'm sorry?
I assume it was horrible.
It was. It was bad. Every day, you weren't fighting every day, but every day you were looking over your shoulder. There were days where you got a chance to go to the village, and you got some free time. So we had a base camp. The way it was set up, we have a base camp. You go into your base camp. There were people that never left the base camp, and they were running like small cities. So you had all kinds of occupations. You had truck drivers. You had mail clerks. Yeah, people that worked in office. And at that time period, not now, but that time period, for every guy they put out in the field, it took 5 guys to keep him there. So we had and while I was there, Vietnam was considered our 10th largest city. We had that many troops over there. So we had something like 500,000 or 600,000 troops in Vietnam at one time.
What was the big base that you were at?
I was in, called Zion.
Zion.
Right.
X-I-A-N or Z-I-A-N or whatever.
I'm trying to think how it was spelled. D-I-A-Z or something.
Okay.
Z-I. But we never spent much time there. So the troop that I was in was a Vanguard group, which would meant that what we did when there was a when something place got hit, our job was to go out, secure the place, get rid of the troops that was there, and then move on to the next spot. Troops would come in behind us. So for instance, you had airstrips, and they were bombing airstrips, and they had guys who would take over airstrips because the airstrips, they had them throughout the jungle where they would land planes, drop off supplies, and take off again. So there are certain strategic places where they needed troops to maintain. If something broke out there, our job was to go in and secure it, and then other guys would come behind us and keep it secure. So obviously we constantly saw a lot of firepower. I think the worst thing happened, it's kind of not funny and funny, is we went, what was there in 68? So in 68 they had the Tet Offensive. My group was the first group because a part of what our job was, and because we were close to Saigon, our post wasn't far from Saigon, I think maybe 30 miles. So we had to go to Saigon. It was New Year's Eve. I had never been drunk before. So everybody said, oh, it's New Year's Eve, we're back in the rear, because we don't go back in the rear that often.
American New Year's Eve or Tet?
I think it was Tet. I guess it was Tet, because they don't coincide. But anyway, we decided to go out and party. And I had never drank before. I mean, I never had beer, wine, anything. So he says, well, Brooks, you need to get drunk. At least have, no, they didn't say get drunk. You need to have some drinks. I said, fine. Eventually, what happened? I got drunk. So I go to bed that night in our little thing, our little cabins back at the base camp. Middle of the night, they woke us up and said, we got to get out. We got to move out. Grab your stuff. We have to go to Vietnam. I mean, you have to go to Saigon. It was just hit. And of course, our job is to go in and secure places that were hit. I mean, I was literally blind. I was so drunk I couldn't see, and I'm stumbling around grabbing my stuff. I said, oh God, what a time. I didn't panic though, which surprised me. Well, by that time, I'd been over there about 7 months, 8 months. So I kind of used to the drill. And anyway, we wound up going to Saigon. And so the battle was taking place out in the street. I got behind a wall, just held my gun up and just fired, pulled it back down. I didn't even stand up. It's more firepower, just hold it up. So, I mean, that was the humor of it. The crazy part of it, that it was really, really outrageous. And the number of people that were killed. That was awful. So what I did, I actually kept a picture of it just so as a reminder to show people how terrible this war is. I mean, war is absolutely awful. Kids are killed. I'll be fine.
You can take a minute.
Yeah, could I?
Please do. Brooks, I think
Yeah.
that this helps explain. As long as I knew you were always opposed to war.
Yeah, because you see the destruction and devastation. It's like, this is so crazy. You see kids walking around that are, some of them, you see dead kid bodies where you see them with limbs missing. You see kids, their towns have been devastated, and the fields where they work and live have been devastated. And you see them in the garbage pile, searching around for garbage just to get enough to live and eat and sustain themselves. And when we think about war, people don't really think about the devastation part of it and how it impacts people in communities. I mean, people have real lives; they live in real communities.
Here, can you hear me?
Anyway, I think what we don't really think enough about that part of it. And it's pretty reckless what we do. And so,
Well, jumping way ahead, I remember one of your leadership was to be active in labor against the, or
cool.
I believe it was the Iraq War.
Right. And I'm still in touch with a lot of those people. And time to time, we do stuff.
Coming from
Yeah, up until about 2 years ago, when I retired, I got a little bit active in it. But you know, I because of Joanne's health and other factors, I kind of pulled away. But I still get their correspondence from time to time,
mm-hmm.
and about the stuff that's happening over in the Middle East now, with the Palestinians and Hamas and that kind of thing. And it's pretty bad. I don't think we realize how what's going on or how bad it is, but it is pretty horrendous. There were a number, obviously, quite a few people feel the exact same way I do about war. And I'm going to jump back a little bit, but when I was in high school, his name was Dr. Kendall. He was my professor I think it might have been civics or sociology. I can't remember what, but it was in high school. He was a brilliant guy, and we talked about it. We should talk about war and how crazy it was. And he was talking about all wars were wars of economics, you know. And I thought a lot about that during that time period. And we've talked about the Civil War. We moved up into World War II, World War I, World War II, and those kind of things. So, I mean, it was probably a discussion that was a little bit ahead of our time for the time period and also for our age. But people grasped it and really got it and made us think a lot about it. And that long after that, then we have the Vietnam War happening. And you see it play out every night on TV, too, so which you don't do now purposely. They don't want that shown.
I'm ready to move on.
Okay.
Are you?
Yeah, I'm fine.
If there's anything more you want to add about those years.
I don't know if there's much more to tell. I mean, I was glad to get the help out of there, but I felt really bad about the war because, like I said, I understood the things that were going on.
What about race relations?
I'm sorry?
Race relations.
They were pretty bad, and they were pretty bad in Vietnam. They were all black troops, company. So my group was a unit. Our unit was called the 1st and 18th. Within that unit or brigade, there is like about probably about 8 companies. Each company has about 40 men. So it's company A, B, C, and we made D company, new guys coming in. So I was always part of D.
Company D.
Yeah, so
race relations.
You talk about the race. Yeah, and you know, when I wrote Kennedy, I talked a lot about that as well. The guys that were in the troops together, whether you're white or black, we got along. It was the superior officers, and we felt that they were trying to separate us, and that there was a lot of racism at that level. So at the troop level, I don't think there was. And I actually had friends, which was kind of funny for me, but there were a number of troops from the South. They said they never had a black friend before. And black people were so much different than what they heard. I just thought that was humorous. I said, really, what do you think we were like? I said, just different than what you really are. So the troops themselves got along, and they needed to because they depended on each other. But there were a lot of discrimination amongst the ranks. For instance, I told you there were different occupations throughout that post. There were a number of people that was in Vietnam that never actually saw any action because they didn't have to. They didn't go outside those posts. But those jobs were never any minorities in those jobs, like none that I saw. And I'm sure probably maybe someplace. My base was pretty large. They actually had a landing strip in that base where we land large planes at. So.
Well, thank you for all this information.
Okay. Were you ready to move on? I am when you are.
It's very powerful. I could listen to this for a long time, but let's move on.
Okay.
You came back from Vietnam. This is now 69?
I got back in 68. I went over in 66.
Okay,
tell
us. I
got back in 68. I got back the latter part of 68.
What did you do next?
Well, nothing much. I kind of hung out. Like I said, I was involved in a few protests. Up in Camden, there were protests at my high school.
So So did you go to work or
I didn't work for a few months. I didn't do either. I knew I wanted to go to college, but I figured I got home and I just wanted to cool off a bit. And then, you know, the other thing is when I left to go to Vietnam, one of the things is, or go into service, I got drafted. They said if you get drafted, because I was working when I got drafted. I worked at Campbell Soups, making soup of all things. And they said you would get your job back, because when you get drafted, you're entitled to get your job back. When I came back, I couldn't get the job back. And I was a little concerned. And so no matter where we went, now, I'm thinking we have to understand back during that time period, the Vietnam War was, people started hating the war, but they hated the people that participated in the war. And I didn't talk about this. I came back with three friends. I went over with three friends. We came back. Fortunately, we all came back together. And we talked about that. Now, we were dropped off in San Francisco. We were, and so we said we have to, you figure I've been away for over a year and a half, you'd be rushing to get back home. Well, we were a little intimidated because we didn't realize what people thought of us, what our families would think of us. We were in this brutal war. And they would call you baby killers and stuff like that. So we didn't know how that was. You got news. You didn't get a lot of it, but you did get some news. And so that was a concern to us. So we wanted to just kind of bond for a couple of days before we split. We spent the last year and a half being together every day.
You went back to the Camden area?
No, well, I went to Lawnside.
Okay. So the next
So we couldn't get jobs. We couldn't get jobs. So we tried, for a long time. We tried to get, I couldn't get a job. No matter what, you were a Vietnam veteran. Okay, we'll think about it. What is this about? Right.
So how did you get working for the state?
I started working for the state after I got out of college. I'm trying to think if I worked before then.
So you went, you went to college.
Right, I went to college.
Where'd you go?
I went to, my first school was Hartford, Connecticut, School of Accounting.
On VA benefits?
Yeah. I paid for part of it. My parents paid for part, and then VA benefits. I stayed there for about 6 months, and then I left, and I decided to go to Rutgers. So, and the reason why, because Rutgers was offering money, and I could get money for being a minority. So I figured, well, and also my girlfriend went there. So she kept telling me to come to Rutgers.
Had a program then at Rutgers, University, to increase minority enrollment?
Exactly. Absolutely.
So you got a scholarship?
Yeah.
And what did you study in?
I studied political science and sociology.
And got your BA?
Yes.
Okay.
In sociology.
Okay. And then you went to work?
Yeah. I went to work for the federal government. I did the disaster relief for the federal government for about a year.
Okay. I want to try and jump up to when you started working for
with
the state.
I was taking a number of state jobs, tests, because they was told that, being a veteran, you had lists, and you got on a list based on your grade, how you finished the test. Well, all veterans were pushed to the top of the list, and I was encouraged to take a lot of, and my girlfriend actually wound up being my wife. I married her, which is not Joanne. And so she has worked for the state. She says, you should take this job, blah, blah, blah. Tests. And if you take these tests, being a veteran, you'll probably go to the top of the list. My first job was with one of our locals, actually. It was the Middlesex County Welfare.
You worked in the welfare office.
Yeah, that was my first job. I forgot. I skipped along. I was in school. Mm-hmm. And I was going to school at Rutgers. And I got a job at Middlesex County. So that was my first public sector experience.
Okay.
And I was going to school full time, and I worked it out, negotiated with them. They allowed me to work at the agency full time, and I could leave and come back after to go to class. And that's what I did. I forgot about that.
Good for you. Okay.
So that was my first interest in public sector.
Okay, so you were working for the state, and this is the early.
That was 1972.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
And Then did you?
Well, after I got out of school.
Okay,
I moved to Trenton.
Trenton.
So I graduated from school. I went to Trenton.
And where did you work then?
And then I worked. I got a job with Department of Transportation.
Okay.
Because my wife worked there, and she got me a job. So.
Very good. Okay, so.
And then I took the test, and then ended up in taxation.
You ended up in the Department of Taxation?
Yes, the Treasury Department.
What were you doing?
I was collecting taxes.
Okay, that's what you
no,
do.
No, well, that's basically the job. But I went after delinquent taxpayers.
Okay. Okay, so I want to go to the State Worker Organizing Committee.
Okay.
How did you get involved in that and why?
Well, there was a law passed about the union. I was in the union. I was in the employees union. It wasn't that effective. So I was basically a member just on paper. They would come around, have meetings at the office, went to the meetings, and there was talk about more unions coming in. So there was AFSCME, United Food and Commercial Workers, AFT. So I thought at that point, now I always had concerns about what was happening how employees were being treated, et cetera. And so I used to have discussions with my supervisor about stuff like that anyway. And just little stuff that was just irritating. Anyway, when the union came around, and then I heard about, and then we would have these meetings, and they said they were going to affiliate with AFSCME. So I said, I think I better get involved because I like to have some input on what they're doing, the association. And so anyway, I heard about CWA, and I went to one of their meetings. I was impressed by what they were talking about.
Who was the they?
I'm trying to think. I think it might have been Carol Gay. And so I would meet with her and talk to her about it, and she was explaining that she worked for the welfare in Camden. Well, I'm from Camden. My first experiences was with the welfare. So we had that in common. And so I would meet with her and talk about it. And she would say, you want to volunteer to help out? And I said, yeah, fine. And that's how I got involved. So in the mornings, I'd get up in the mornings, go leaflet, and then go to work. And then eventually I met Larry. And it went, I hate to use a cliche, but the rest is history, I guess, after I met Larry.
What impact did he have on you?
Oh, a lot. And I think one of the things, and that's another thing I was pretty... Larry Cohen, right. Mm-hmm. We went to a Saturday session. And it was a volunteer session. It was an educational session. And I think it was about 20 of us there, or 25 people. And we spent the day there. And we went through all this, the drive, the organizing drive, a lot of the issues that we were experiencing. And we were able to walk through them. He kind of walked us through them. It was really an eye-opening, and I thought, this is fantastic. And you might remember, too, that one of the things I've always was big on is education, because it made such a difference. It's not enough to tell people this is the right thing. I think people need to know why and understand it. And so I always felt passionate about that as well. But that made a big difference for me.
This was a day-long session.
It was a day-long
CWA
session.
CWA organized?
Yeah.
With the top organizers?
No, it was just the people that had volunteered. They had wanted us to go through the session.
Volunteered to be active in the
be
organizing
active,
drive.
Be active in the organizing drive. Now, so they had done something to display that their activity. They either did leafleting or they did certain things to help get people to meetings. And they were identified as people that we might want to invest more in, right? So those people were identified, and then they were asked would they would come to a meeting. And those that agreed would go to the meeting. And then there was this session where we talked about the campaign, we talked about CWA, and we talked about what we were trying to achieve, why it was important.
And did you become one of the leaders organizing in the taxation department?
Yes. So eventually I organized while I was working, and they said, listen, we'd like for you to come off full time. And what we'll do is take you off on leave of absence.
CWA would.
They had the ability to do that, which they don't do in most campaigns, is because they had affiliated with SEA. SEA? The New Jersey State Workers were actually represented by two different organizations, which is kind of weird. So they had joint certification, which means that you could leave one organization and go to the other. And so you could go back and forth, but the organizations were ran totally different. CWA and Larry was smart enough to affiliate it with Carol Wade's group. I'm trying to think, what was that called? It wasn't called SCA. It's called something else.
Oh, so she had a different... Was this an organizing drive or already had been...
It had already been there. So the state workers had a union, mm-hmm. was more or less a association.
Mm-hmm.
So that means they didn't have chapters anywhere else. It was just there.
And Carolyn Wade was in that organization?
Right. As was, I don't know, you probably don't know him, Norm. He was the head of it, and Carol Wade worked for him. And it was joint certification. So there's two separate organizations representing the same people.
Hmm.
And you could go from organization to organization, which is very unusual.
And eventually they were merged?
So, no, they never merged. So what happened, CWA merged with one of the groups.
Oh, one of the
right,
groups
one of the
that
two
state.
Groups, right, exactly.
And that was Carolyn Wade's group?
That was Carolyn Wade's
which
group.
Which was a lot of the welfare, right?
No.
Oh, no. I mean...
This is state workers.
Oh, so she had health and hospitals, right?
She did hospitals. Well, she did, yeah, institutions.
The institutions.
They were all institutions. Mm-hmm. And I think, if I remember correctly, and Larry probably brought this out, is that he started off organizing institution workers first. It failed. He came back, so he had already had, my guess is, a relationship with that organization already. This is organizing institutional workers. He came back, and I guess they started to do a wider spread campaign.
So you were taken off, CWA paid your lost time.
Right.
And then you were signing up
right.
members. And then eventually you had an election
right.
and won.
Right.
And then?
There was never any doubt that we were going to win. I don't know why, but we were very cocky, very sure of ourselves. We figured this is the right way to go, and people will see it. Of course, that's not necessarily true, but, you know, we were young, we're naive. But anyway, so there were, I think there, we started at about six or seven of us. Original people that were taken off the job. Our job, obviously, to organize, but also find out the leaders, develop other leaders. And so since I came out of taxation, I got taxation to do. And taxation is part of treasuries. So within treasury, there are other groups. There's banking, there's insurance. So I started branching out into those places as well because nobody else would do it.
So you're recruiting not just... Let me say it differently. You're recruiting people from a variety of job titles.
Right.
From clerical to professional.
Exactly.
Tax assessors and...
Right.
And they were interested in joining the union.
Yeah, you know, they had some union sense because they were part of the association.
Mm-hmm.
They didn't have a lot of it, but they knew enough that we should join the association. They weren't particularly active in the association.
Okay, so now... the state workers have their union, CWA, and are you working for the union, for the local? And what local did you become?
Well, I became 1033,
okay.
But I was a founder of 1033. So our local is made up based on the places that I organized.
And so which departments were that?
So it was nine different departments. So it was Department of Treasury, which included all those other little offices, law and public safety, trying to think what else, law and public safety, education,
and very much Trenton based.
Right.
People who
they
work.
Still, that local is still formatted the same way. They still represent those people. So the idea was we will represent all those people. So the local was set up by departments. And it was set up geographically. So the people I represented in Trenton might have been represented, or were represented by different local in northern Jersey, as well as south Jersey.
Okay.
But because of, now the uniqueness of New Jersey is that most of the workers work in and around Trenton, which is the capital. And the rest of the agency for more or less, trying to get a word, extensions of that.
Mm-hmm.
So there were field offices.
Yeah, except for the institutions.
Right, except for the institutions.
Were you the local president?
Yes.
for what years? About.
1981 through, to I guess, till 86, 87.
Okay, so for 6 years you were president of the local
right.
1033.
Right.
I'm going to jump past
Go
that
ahead.
Now. And then you ran to be the vice president of the public workers
yeah,
sector?
Actually, I stepped down from being local president, and I went back to work for the local. And then I was recruited, said, listen, you know, we think you would probably be good as vice president. And I said, I don't know if I want it, blah, blah, blah. My daughter was just born. I had just gotten married again. My daughter was born, so I said, I don't know if I wanted to do that. Well, we think we need somebody, blah, blah, blah. And he says, there is not really many minorities on CWA executive board. Might be something you might be interested in. And I said, I'll think about it. And my name was entered into the hat, and I was getting calls talking about, we heard you're running for office. I said, I'm not aware of that. But anyway, I eventually, in about a month or so, decided to run a full campaign, and I did it.
What year were you elected?
I was elected in 1989.
Now,
before that,
yep.
Which was another thing, is that I was selected by the public sector locals as local president. They had this thing that Ed Schultz had, and it was called the Public Sector Bargaining Council, where what he did, and I knew Ed Schultz because Ed Schultz had worked in New Jersey.
He was staff, right?
Yeah, I'm sorry?
He was CWA staff, am I
yeah,
correct?
Yeah, he was staff.
In District 1?
Yeah. I don't know if he was staff. He was something, but I don't know if he was staff. I know he worked for 1040.
Local 1040.
1040.
Okay.
I think he was staff. The history that I heard, I guess Larry can verify it, is that he worked for AFSCME. He was a staff person for AFSCME. He had a big fight with AFSCME, and so he decided to leave AFSCME, and CWA had been trying to recruit him anyway, and what he did is he went with CWA, but they had these petitions that they were going to enter for election. He took the petition, didn't enter them for AFSCME, he entered them for CWA. And he told me this himself, so.
Okay.
And that's how we ended up with the public sector in
New Jersey. So you had this public sector council.
Right. So anyway, they had this organization, and we met like once or twice a year in D.C. It's called the Public Sector Bargaining Committee. And they would come together and they'd talk about different issues in the public sector. And so I got a chance during those type of meetings to meet people from around the country.
Although at that point, public sector in CWA was primarily New Jersey or New York, correct?
They had them all over. So they had, I'll tell you what I meant. I mean, they had New Mexico, they had Florida. I'm trying to think where else, Wisconsin.
In the late 80s?
Yeah.
Okay.
Oh, absolutely, yeah. Now, I'm not sure where they come from.
But they were small locals, weren't they?
Yeah, but I didn't have the history of them, but they were there. They were local presidents. Oh. They all came into this meeting that Ed Schultz was running.
Okay.
And that's also Missouri came in around that time period. So, and Larry was recruiting people because he tried to recruit me to go to Texas. To go organize in Texas.
Texas State
right.
Employees Union.
Right. And so that was during the late 80s. I think they also tried to recruit me to go to California. They organized the California workers. Not UPTI, but there was a California group that they were organizing. That eventually fell. We had them for a while and eventually fell through.
So at any rate, I believe that by 89, there was a vice president over the public sector, but that was the first. You were the first, correct?
No, I was not.
Oh.
Connie Bryant was the first.
She was a VP or she was a director?
I think they made her. She came in as a director, and I think they changed it and made it a VP.
Okay.
So she spent one term as a director, one term as a VP, I believe.
Okay.
Eddie Schultz started it. He brought Eddie Schultz to Washington. He would have these public sector meetings from around the country. They didn't consist of much. But he would bring us in. But the good thing is we got a chance to meet. And that's big, too. That's important because it's during those meetings that we come in. We said, this is such a waste. And that was so much more that we could do. Eddie Schultz told us that, so we challenged Eddie Schultz, how come we can't get more substance in the meetings? And so he says, well, I'm not allowed, I'm only staff, and I don't have the right to make any decisions. So then we started exploring the executive board. Come to find out there's no public sector on the executive board. At this point, we're starting to grow, because we came in with New Jersey, 30,000, I think 35,000, and then we had that's not counting the welfare locals, and not counting the other places I talked about. So when we had that meeting, I had called the meeting together in my room, hotel room, and talked to some of the players here and said, listen, there's something we need to do. Eddie Schultz is our representative, but of all the people that have representatives, the other sectors, they're all elected. It wasn't vice president, but they were elected. So we think our position needs to be elected too. What do people think about that? They all agree. So we said, what we're going to do is we're going to try to get the rest of the public sector involved, and we're going to send a resolution to the convention.
And that would be a constitutional amendment.
Correct? Right, that's what we did, constitutional amendment. And so we met, and then we had a public sector conference. So us as leaders went to that conference, because that meeting was before the conference. We went to the conference, we solidified it at the conference, and then we started pushing for it. Now, what happened was, we didn't have a personality in mind. We just had a position in mind. Glenn Watts decided, he really liked Connie Bryant. So he thought this would be good for Connie Bryant. She's a minority, she's a woman. She had been active, she had high visibility because she was on the Committee of the Future. That's what it was, so she was on the Committee of the Future. So because of that, he wanted to push her for the slot. And so some people weren't with it. And Eddie Schultz obviously was running for it himself. He was a mixed bag. Some people really liked him. He either really liked him or didn't like him at all. He was that kind of a person. And anyway, so the rest is history. Connie got elected at that.
86 probably,
I think
then?
That was 86.
So the same year that you got the Constitution Amendment through, then you
they
that
had an
same
election.
Elected.
Yeah, you know, there was a convention in between that too. Mm-hmm. It was called the Committee of the Future.
And that's when
that's where they submit the recommendations. I forgot that part. So the recommendation was committed to that body, and they agreed, right? Why shouldn't the public sector have their own identity? Mm-hmm. And that was written into the Committee of the Future. I still have those reports at home. So that was written into the proposal.
Okay, so you ran in 89 and
right.
You won.
Right.
Okay, and then you come down and you were a long-serving vice president until when?
Until 2019.
When you came on the executive board, how many other people of color were on the executive board?
One black person, one woman.
The one black person was you.
Right. The one woman was Barbara Eastland.
That's right, because by then, Dina Beaumont was executive assistant. She
right.
was no longer on the executive board.
Right.
What was it like?
It was different. Because you had a couple challenges, right? First, being the only black, and then second of all, being from a total different industry, which people didn't want to talk much about anyway. I found out later because they knew so little about it. So it was kind of intimidating for them to talk about the public sector. So they just chose to sweep it to the back. So it was always that struggle trying to get it front and center.
What structures were there during the 90s, even 2000s, for people of color within the union?
Not much.
I'm going to be kind of general about that over 20-year period that you were a public worker vice president. Are there
right.
particular activities or achievements that you would want to talk about?
I think a lot of it was around the training that we did. I mean, with your help as well, in the research department, we put out a lot of educational materials. I think you did something on prisons and... I don't call them prison guards, but public safety officers that work in prisons. We put out a number of things. We did stuff about taxes, and we ran training on taxes and budgeting. I think the biggest thing we did was teaching workers or teaching the locals that a lot of their achievements come from within the local. Too often they were looking to the national to do everything for them. And we said, listen, with good training and working at it, you can do it. And I think Chris was very good at that too, Chris Kennedy.
He was your assistant.
He was my assistant. Not initially, but he eventually. Eileen Curlin was my assistant for a while. And she did a very good job. I think, I'm skipping her name. This is crazy. Louise.
Novotny.
Louise Novotny, right. I mean, that lasted for about 2 weeks. She was the assistant.
She was an assistant to Connie Bryant, I think.
Yeah, she was. But see, Connie Bryant had left. I came in behind Connie Bryant, so she was still there. And she was telling me, it was so funny. I kept saying, well, what do you think about this? She says, Brooks, I'm not going to be here. I'm leaving. I said, well, before you leave, what do you think about this? We had a good relationship because I used to talk to her all the time prior to coming to D.C. So I couldn't reach Connie Bryant, so I'd run it through Louise. And that's how I got to know Louise. And so I felt I had the hand on the pulse of what people were thinking. And that helped her out a lot as well.
Well, one of the innovations, I think, of CWA in the public sector was in the states that did not have collective bargaining.
Oh, that's very, yeah. I didn't think about that.
And
that's
I know
true.
That MACE, Mississippi Alliance of State Employees, was a big project of yours.
Right.
Talk a little about that.
No, that was fantastic. And, of course, I worked with Danny Spontanti on that. But the one that, I mean, that was already started when I got elected.
Which one? Texas
State Employees. And that was the only one that was started at that time, which was fascinating to me because of what they were able to achieve without collective bargaining. And so that was duplicated in Mississippi. It was duplicated in Oklahoma, which I was in from the start. And I think that was, and the idea was that we were able to achieve this stuff, and it brought home the point, the central point of the union, is that it's our unity that is our power. And not through laws and various regulations. And if we get that through, there's nothing that we couldn't accomplish. And so a lot of my remarks, is when I spoke, I talked a lot about that and why that's important. Because initially, particularly from where I came from, people thought you could solve everything by going to court, by filing a grievance. And the unity part was always lost. You know, so that drove the point home. And then the other point I think that's fascinating is that was the largest public, not the largest public, I think the largest local in CWA. Did
TSEU.
You know that? Yeah, TSEU.
Eventually.
Yeah.
It was about 10,000 people, or 10 or 12 at its height.
Yeah, well, it was about 10,000 people, right. Which is fascinating, given they don't have any collective bargaining right. At one point, they didn't even have dues checkoff. They eventually got dues checkoff. I think you know about that story. And we were able to do that in other places. So we got dues checkoff in Mississippi. And, of course, they had it in Missouri already. And we're also in Oklahoma. Oklahoma is very difficult because they had another association there. And they had a long history of that association.
Mm-hmm.
So that's what made that very difficult.
So I think I asked you a question then when we didn't. We took a break. Within the union, what structures were there to develop leadership and to address issues of people of color?
You said nothing, and within our union?
Within CWA, yeah.
Well, they had the minority caucus, and then they started the equity committees to deal with that. The minority caucus, I thought, was very important because they kind of wasn't on getting paid by CWA. So they weren't getting money through from CWA.
The minority caucus. This was a grassroots effort.
Right, they were more grassroots. They had their own money coming in.
From where?
From the membership. It wasn't a lot, but it was money coming in from the membership.
So people would pay dues to
the minority caucus?
Mm-hmm.
So it was truly a membership organization where people paid dues to be a part of it.
And elected leaders?
And they elected leaders.
Who were some of the leaders?
Well, Amanda, Andrew, was one of them. Who else was? Rudy.
What was Rudy's last name?
I'm trying to think of Rudy's last name. I don't remember Rudy's last name. Rudy Francis.
Mm-hmm. Where was he from?
Louisiana, District 3. And I don't, his locals, whatever locals in Louisiana, he's part of that local. And Andrews succeeded him.
Walter Andrews. From Atlanta, right?
From Atlanta, right.
And what did they push for, and what was accomplished?
Well, I think getting one of the things they pushed that the executive board didn't like, they passed this resolution where executive board had to get equity training. I don't know if you remember that, and I think you were around that. So they had to be trained in equity. They pushed for...
What does that mean?
Well, they wanted them trained in... what's the word I'm looking for? I guess it was racial sensitivity training.
Was it any good? Use words.
I went through it. I thought it was. You know who helped put it together was Yvette.
Yvette Herrera.
Yeah. So they pushed for that, and they felt very uncomfortable. But it was done not to ruffle any feathers. And see what else they do. From what I was told, they pushed to get the first seat that I was in, or Connie was in. They fought about that at the executive board. I mean, at the convention. So they were leaders in that fight. And I don't remember that, but that's what they said.
Because a lot of the people of color were coming out of the public sector. Is that correct?
Right. Well, we had a higher percentage. Our percentage in the public sector is probably about 35-40% minorities. 50% women. So it's the highest ratio of both groups.
When you're saying minorities, I want to know, you mean African-American, Latino?
African-American, but also Latinos as well. So Afro-Americans, Latinos, and other groups, Asians. There wasn't that many Asians in CWA, not that I know of, but.
So was the Minority Caucus a arena for to cultivate black leadership and push and minority issues?
They were good at pushing minority issues. I'm not sure about the leadership. They didn't have any formal structure where they actually brought leaders and trained them. Now, CWA's equity committee did that, right? And the whole idea of the equity committee was to bring leaders in, which, by the way, the minority caucus, from what I was told before I got there, actually pushed for that. Because they said they were constantly being told there were no minority leaders because they didn't have the background or the training or something. So they pushed for training. And as a result of that training, you had the Minority Leadership Institute, which they came into Washington for, and I think you taught at it once.
Did you? Maybe, but
yeah. But anyway, they would come in. They would come in. So one person per district, one minority per district would come in to CWA headquarters once a year, and they would stay about 3 or 4 weeks. And they would train in different, aspects of the job. So politically, they were trained. They were trained how to speak in front of people, how to write articles, a number of mechanical things as well as political things.
Was it effective?
You know what? I thought it was somewhat.
Do you remember some individuals who
came up through that?
Mm-hmm.
Let me think. And there are some. Off the top of my head, I have to think about it because I can't put my finger on any one person. No.
Mm-hmm.
But they wind up going back and becoming staff reps. And I don't know if Claude went through that. I think Claude might have gone through that.
Claude Cummings.
Claude Cummings, right. Which would be the biggest testimony.
After you, what was the next person of color on the executive board?
See, let me think. Well, Claude, when we pushed for the equity seats, so that was Claude.
Mm-hmm.
The equity seats.
Before that.
I can't think of anybody before that.
I'm wondering about Linda Hinton. No, because it was Seth.
She wasn't on the board.
She
yet.
Hadn't been. Elected
no,
yet?
Steph would, no, she hasn't been elected yet. Linda hasn't been around too long. I mean, she's been around long, but not in that position that long. Maybe she might be in her third or fourth term.
Mm-hmm. And from any of the sectors.
So most of them came through the equity committee. I think that was it.
So until the vote to create the minority seats,
there were not.
The four, there, right. You were the only African-American and no Hispanics on the executive board?
No.
In a union that at that point was what percent people of color?
I don't know, but it was pretty high. You know, it might have been about 25%.
At least.
Yeah, easily. Matter of fact, there was an oversight of Latinos. So when they picked out this committee and they were put, we had a committee. So I was part of the committee.
Which committee were you
talking about?
There
was a committee that created this whole board seats, the four board seats.
Come up with the proposal, right?
Right.
Which then had to be voted on.
Exactly, at the convention.
And you were on that committee.
Right.
Okay.
And I think Barbara Leaston led that committee up. So on that committee, I was chosen to be on there for obvious reasons, but they had no Latinos on that committee. So they had women on the committee, they had some staff white men, but no Latinos. So I did raise that, because I think everybody should be represented. So what they did, they didn't go back and put a person on there, but what they did, we used to travel from different districts. As we were in a district, they would have their Latino people come in and offer and speak and offer what they thought about, you know, what we were doing.
So we've talked about at the top level of the union, it was really until the equity seats,
right,
which I believe is 2007,
right,
that they're finally
so prior
became
to that, right. So that's from 1989 that I was on there. And prior to that, you had Connie. So from that time period all the way up until, you said it was 2007? Okay, I didn't remember the dates. There were no minorities on there.
And what about, what were you hearing was going on in the locals in terms of folks, people of color, feeling like they were being treated in an equitable way and able to move into leadership, et cetera?
You know what? I mean, I used to have discussions with various people and leaders from around the country, but at some point they had become very comfortable just having me there. At least we got representation, right? And that's not enough, because I'm only one person, and, you know, I don't have the power to get stuff done as one person. You do need other people. And at that time, I think Linda came on the board, so
Linda
we got
Hinton.
Linda Foley.
Oh, Linda Foley
right,
from
way
the Guild.
Way before Linda mm-hmm. Hinton. So and then, so it's Barbara East and Linda Foley and myself. So Alicia had three of us that was on the board. Oh, no, there's one before her, Janice.
Oh, Janice Wood out of District
right,
9.
Right, District 9, because she lost. She was on one term. She lost the election. So she was on the board. I think she was on the board same time as Linda Foley. And that came through affiliation. Then you had also the women from the airlines. So we got women on the board. Think about this. You didn't have
Freud.
Women.
Yeah.
You got women on the board from affiliations and not from within, which is kind of bad, except for Barbara Eastland.
Right.
She's the only one that came through CWA ranks and got on the board. And I was the only person of color at that point. They came through the ranks and got on the board.
So in terms of, we've talked about national leadership. At the local level, did you see a change over this period?
Yeah,
in
I did,
terms
absolutely.
Of equity?
Absolutely.
Talk a
so,
little bit
well,
about
I mean,
it.
When you started to see a change in within the local leadership as more people started running for offices and stuff. You got to figure, out of the 35,000 state workers that I came out of, I was only elected leader that was a minority.
Really?
Yeah. So you had eight locals, and I was local president, and that was it, right? And then eventually that started gradually to change.
What about Carolyn Wade?
Carolyn Wade, well, she wasn't there. No, Carolyn Wade was in the local, but she was not she was not a president.
Okay.
In fact, she became president after I left.
Oh, okay.
So she became president after 89.
Mm-hmm.
Up to that point, it was Norman. I can't remember Norman's last name. But Norman was the president.
So did that change even within the New Jersey state worker locals?
It has changed, but it's still not it's still not that great. It did change somewhat. The locals that were welfare locals, I call them social workers, they had minority leadership.
And that was countywide.
Right. Mm-hmm. So the locals here, because, you know, as you probably noticed too, each state is different. Some are state level, some are county based. New Jersey is county based. And so each county, each one of the counties, they had different makeup. Some of them had minority leadership. Not a lot even there.
So do you think there was a period in which people of color said the locals dominated by whites, there's no reason to get active? Or were there caucuses or whatever that were...
Well, I mean, when you came out with the minority caucus, that, I mean, with the, you know, CWA creates this equity committee. So every local was told they had to have an equity committee. And then with inside of that, alongside of that, you had the minority caucus. And the minority caucus pulled, obviously, from the locals. And so that was a committee sometime, not in every local, because it wasn't mandated. But some locals actually had a minority caucus group. And those groups would meet. And sometimes they would be the same people. So the person that was on the minority caucus was also on the equity committee. And I think that transfusion helped a lot too, right? Because that way they didn't do as much to my liking as I thought they should have. Because when I got elected, I spoke before them several times. And I thought one of the things they should do is they should build the United Front with a women's group. It was a women's caucus. They didn't see it necessarily that way, so it didn't happen.
This was a minority caucus.
Right, minority caucus.
Which still exists?
Yeah, it still exists.
And the committee on equity still exists?
I don't know about the equity committee. I'm assuming it does, but I don't know.
Okay.
Because Claude came up through some of that stuff, too.
Claude Cummings.
He was vice president. Claude Cummings, vice president of the minority caucus for a number of years. So he was vice president of that group. Now, I don't know if he went to the Minority Leadership Institute, but I know his successor did, which was
Walter Andrews.
Walter Andrews, mm-hmm. Right. So he definitely did. Because I used to go to those things and talk to him. But out of that group, which did help, it developed a lot of local leadership. So you had locals, vice presidents that were minorities, women that were minorities, all of them coming through that group. So that was, I think it was, you know, not as effective as it probably could have been, but it was somewhat effective because it helped develop people. Because, you know, if you're in a group like that and you're the minority of a group, it's somewhat intimidating as well, right? So you're just not going to go in and try to take over, run for office. Some locals were more liberal than others. Some locals said, no way, we're not, you know, you can be a shop steward, but you can't be, you know. And nobody stops you from running, but it was hard to get elected. And so you start to see that change. And I think both of those groups helped. Now, one of the things Larry did, he started having the groups meet together when he became president. So he would bring in, and he would officially recognize the minority caucus and bring them in and have them meet with the equity committee. So it was all one meeting, mm-hmm. which I thought was very good and important. And you know, they started getting some recognition along the way. Because one of the things they would do at the convention is have all the vice presidents come in and address the group. Now the problem I had with it, I thought, is they should be allowed to ask questions. So they didn't want to go there. I don't know why. So if they're going to appear before you and speak before you, you should be allowed to ask them questions and find out what their feelings are and what their thoughts are and whatever, you know. They came in, they speak, and then they left. So.
Well, I think I have asked the questions about that arena. Are there other things you want to talk about, Brooks, and sort of sum up your career in the union?
I was very disappointed in a lot of ways of CWA and their treatment of the public sector. And I think the public sector could have been so much better off, and we could have had a lot bigger growth than we had. And, you know, if I can be honest, the politics got in the way of a lot of stuff that shouldn't have. And at some point, people thought I was trying to build an empire, and my only goal was to build growth within the organization. And I thought that could be achieved. One of the things we did, we brought Mark Bloom in at some point because of the higher education workers. And we needed somebody that had an expertise that could help recruit them. And it worked much more than we anticipated. We were getting calls from all over the country to become part of CWA based on a model that he had built for UPTI and training and working with UPTI.
Let's talk. UPTI is Union of Professional and Technical Employees at the University of California.
Exactly.
Which came into CWA,
I don't remember the year either.
And they had collective bargaining.
Right.
It was
and
a
they
big
did have
unit.
Collective bargaining, right. And there were a lot of unorganizing community colleges, et cetera, particularly in California. That group roughly was about 13,000. Alongside of that group, because they were researchers, was their research clerical staff and support staff that was not organized. They were organized into an independent group. They also came out of ASPE as well. But the time of limitations had passed, which means they could be organized. We were trying to work with them, and Chris Kennedy and Mark Bloom out of my office negotiated their first contract, which was a very good one.
Whose first contract?
The clerical and technical support staff. They had an organization.
Oh.
That they formed.
But not part of CWA.
Not part of CWA.
Mm-hmm.
We were trying to recruit them in. So we said what we'll do is we'll work with you guys, help you out, and we'll negotiate your first contract. But we only did it for 1 year because, you know, the idea was to get them to come into CWA, which didn't happen, but it's a shame. I think we could have put more effort into it, but it might have happened. But anyway, so my whole thing is that we had developed various programs to teach and grow the organization. And, you know, it was met with a lot of resistance. And I think people became very suspicious. What was our motive? You had three people, myself, Mark Bloom, and Chris Kennedy, that I believe, didn't have any political aspirations other than to see the organization run right. And somehow nobody believed that or whatever. But anyway. And so a lot of the stuff that we had recommended was not looked upon favorably.
There were, if I recall, there was a tension between the public sector, which was not geographic, and the traditional CWA structure,
right,
in which there was geographic representation.
Right.
And that was part of what you were dealing with.
Exactly.
With the power coming out of the geography, where in the public sector, you have to influence politicians.
Exactly. Good point.
And
very
so that's
point.
Geography.
That's exactly.
And your view was, but there are issues that a public sector office can
address, right. And it wasn't in competition. And there were a lot of proposals that we ran by them. But it became like a competition or power thing. So, and you're absolutely right the way you explained it. So it's the geographic versus... I talked about this a lot at the executive board because their whole thing was based on we needed to get involved locally with the local politicians. There were no programs to actually do that. Most of our political program was national based, which is fine. We have to do that. But it should also have been considered local based as well, particularly at the state level.
Except New Jersey, I think, was an exception to what you said.
New Jersey was an exception because of the size of the locals.
Yeah, they were politically active,
right,
in the
and they were
local
critical,
and
yeah,
state.
I mean, my local, 1033, had 6,000 people. I was president in 1981. By 1983, I had over $1 million in a kitty that I didn't even spend. So that gives you the magnitude of the size of the amount of resources they could have, right? I had six full-time staff. I had three full-time secretaries. And still was able to accumulate in a very short period of time $1 million, which you're talking about 1982, 83, it's a lot more money than it is now.
Yeah.
So they did a lot of their own things because of that, because they had the resources. Now, Larry was smart enough to make them large enough so they could be self-independent. I think that was well thought out, that he approached it that way. And so that helped make a big difference. They could do a lot of their own stuff.
So to sum up, your changes you saw in the union over those?
Well, tons of changes, right? Just a change of the minority makeup, just in changes of the leadership, the changes in how we approach the work, where we become a little bit more strategic. They started talking about what is the fund, the strategic fund that we have. I mean, you know, I used to complain about that. We used to call it strategic, but we did nothing strategic. I was on the budget committee. Of course, I got kicked off after that, off the committee. But I was on the committee for, I think, about a year and a half or 2 years. They had board committees, and on the board committees, you get assignments. But I could never get on the budget committee. So 1 year, I got on the budget committee. And I talked about we needed to be more strategic in how we spend our money and stuff, and just stop throwing money at stuff. And we could do that, right? Well, eventually, they got to that point, which was great. When they have the strategic and budget committee, and you would have projects and you could submit them in. So that was a big, major change in organization, because a lot of it was about, and understandably, it was just about negotiating a contract. There were things that contracts and issues that weren't going to be solved, particularly in the public sector. Mm-hmm. You can't solve half the problems they have through a contract, because half of them don't even have contract or bargaining. The ones that do have bargaining, it's so limited. What they can bargain, what they can talk about. Mm-hmm. The only places that really had all-out scale bargaining would be UPTI. That's even over New Jersey. So, mm-hmm. So you got to approach the work differently.
Why? What couldn't they bargain over in New Jersey?
I'm trying to think. There were, I mean, they had the right to strike, and we didn't have that right to strike.
You mean California did, but
California, New Jersey did not.
Okay, but you bargained over wages and benefits and
right.
working conditions.
Yeah, it was very narrow. Right. Wages, benefit, and some working conditions.
So I'm going to ask a final question. What difference did being in the union and the leadership make for you in your life?
Oh, tremendous amount of difference, right? First of all, I live a better life. And has, you know, helped me with my outlook. And so I appreciate the union. Without the union, I probably wouldn't be half as thoughtful that I think I am. A lot of things that I've done and been involved in, I probably wouldn't have done it. U.S. labor against the war, a coalition of black trade unions, A. Philip Randolph. So all those organizations, and A. Philip Randolph is a political organization that teaches you how to get people elected, politically elected. I developed a relationship with the Congressional Black Caucus. And helped get certain things done. Had introduced Claude Cummings years ago and his local officer to Al Green. Because Al Green was from Houston. I said, they need to know each other and work together. And today, they're good friends, and they do a lot of work together.
Member of Congress.
Right. Al Green's a member of Congress from Houston, right. Benny Thompson in Mississippi helped us get a lot of stuff done in Mississippi, which would not be possible.
The mayor of Jackson, Mississippi.
I'm sorry?
The mayor of Jackson, Mississippi.
I forgot about him. Him as well. Absolutely.
Say his name.
Let me think of his name. It's an African name.
Is
I know it well.
Lumumba or something?
Yeah.
Okay, we'll look it up.
I was going to look it up, but anyway. He's young. His father was the mayor before he was. He became mayor. That was important because we represent something like 2,000 or 3,000 people in the city of Jackson. I wasn't around long enough through his tenure, but one of the things we were considering working on in organizing other cities in Mississippi, we approached him. I knew his father. His father died in office. They brought in another mayor between that time, and he wanted to run the first time he ran, because they had a midterm election. He lost. So we reached out to him, my office, and told him that we would support him and that he would, if he was seeking re-election, which he said he was, he was going to run during the major election when the other term ended. So I said, we'd be there and we'd support you. Also reached out to Clark. At that time, he was a district VP and got some resources from him, because I couldn't get in front of the national. Yvette was actually pretty good, too, during this period, helping us get some resources. Unfortunately, the local was not necessarily that good. because of, you know, the leadership there was not that great. But we did get him elected. And one of the things we had talked about is that one of the things at Mississippi is they had about six cities that had workers in there that could be organized that were became black mayors that we thought were approachable and that we could organize through that. The mayor of Jackson said when he got elected, he would work with us and help bring them along because most of those other cities always looked to the mayor of Jackson anyway, historically. And so he would help us in that endeavor. Now, he had gotten elected a year before I left.
So at any rate, that was, it didn't happen.
So it didn't happen.
Brooks, I think this has been great. I think it's just been great. I'll give you a chance if there's anything we haven't covered that you want to add.
I might call you when I get home.
You can do that.
At this point, no, I can't think of anything.